the disciples had forgotten to bring any loaves. They had only one loaf with them in the boat. And Jesus was cautioning them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod." They were saying to one another, "It's because we have no loaves." And becoming aware of it, Jesus says to them, this is the question, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Cast your mind back to the scene of the multiplication of loaves." Then they had five and two, yes, but they didn't think they could feed the crowd with this little bit of food. Here they are again saying, "Look, we, the missionaries, we don't have any bread. Why are you saying that?" said Jesus. "Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes that fail to see and ears that fail to hear? Or don't you remember? When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets fulls of broken pieces did you collect?" They thought they didn't have enough. But provided they brought their gift and gave it to Jesus, it was in his hand that the miracle occurred, not in the basket. Because they kept coming back and he kept giving them food. So somehow our small little gifts, whatever they might be, our 1 or 10 talents or whatever, if we offer that to him, in his hands, it's capable of anything God wants to do through us. So he said, "Look, how many basketfuls of broken pieces did you collect?" And they said, "Well, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you collect?" And they said, 7. He's getting them to remember. Then he said to them, "Don't you yet understand? Don't you yet see? Don't you yet grasp what mission is about? And then comes, if you doubt that Mark's gospel is a play, a drama, to communicate the meaning of Jesus, surely this will dissipate any hesitations you've got, because he's saying, "Don't you understand? Can't you see? Can't you hear?" And immediately they come to Bethsaida, and onto the stage walks a disciple who can't see, can't hear, can't understand. That's us. They came to Bethsaida, and some people bring a blind man to them, symbolic of all of us. And as in a moment we'll see, significantly symbolic of Peter. Some people bring a blind man to Jesus and beg him to touch him. Jesus took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he'd put saliva on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he was asking him, "Can you see anything?" And the blind man looked up and said, "I can see people, but they're like trees walking. I can kind of see, I'm beginning to see, but not clearly." And Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again. And if Mark had had time, he would have said again and again and filled up the rest of the gospel, because it doesn't happen just once. He laid his hands on his eyes again, and he looked intently, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Then Jesus sent him away to his home, saying, "Don't even go into the village." Then comes the scene of Caesarea Philippi, which I won't do again. Bethsaida up to Philippi is some kilometres, not too far. He's at the northern part of Galilee, and then he asks, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter, at last, representing the disciples, sees. I'll take that as read. So having said from his heart, without full understanding, of course, "You're the Messiah. You're the one I'm looking forward to. You're the one that we've been promised. You're the one our scriptures are full of." All of that's implied there. You, the Jesus we know, what an extraordinary act of love and faith and insight. That having happened, we're ready to move to the part four of the gospel, which is now facing talking about Jesus, the Son of God. There are three parts to this. The first part is the role of suffering in Jesus' life and in the lives of his disciples. The second part is a disciple must be a servant of Yahweh, a servant of God. And the third part, the disciples must offer their lives for others. So let's begin. Jesus began, don't miss that, he began to teach his disciples that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the Sanhedrin, that is, the elders, the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. He was speaking this quite openly. He's beginning to teach them something. Good psychology here. It's no good teaching this before they've come to commit themselves to him as the Messiah. Now they're ready to hear what's it mean to follow Jesus. And that's what we'll be looking at in this presentation. So he talks about his death, what the must means. I don't exactly know. It's not as if it's predestined or anything, but there's something that's happening here, and maybe we can reflect on it. We needed it, even if certainly God didn't and Jesus didn't, but we needed to see him loving on a cross to get the message. But whatever that, he says he's going to go before the Sanhedrin and be killed, and after 3 days, well, that's quite clear and not a problem in their world, probably because they experienced people apparently dead and coming back to life in a coma or something. They considered that you weren't certain someone was dead till after 3 days. So after 3 days, if they're still unconscious, well, they're dead, so you can bury them and so on. So it just means he'll really die. Let's look at the build-up of the opposition to Jesus, which is now coming to its climax. Right back in chapter 2, we read, "Why does this fellow speak in this way? It's blasphemy, punishable by death. Who can forgive sin but God alone?" Then at the end of chapter 3, we read, "The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him." So now they're set on a path to destroy Jesus. And in chapter 7, we read, "The Pharisees and the scribes asked him, 'Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders? But they eat with defiled hands.' And Jesus said to them, 'Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites. As it is written, the people honours me with lip service. Their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts.' as doctrines we're all likely to be responsible for doing that. The institution is, and we're part of it, so we've got to be so careful. That's why the second commandment is such an important commandment, which I doubt if, well, I don't know, of course, I don't think I've ever been, no one's confessed that in the Sacrament of Reconciliation, to my knowledge. After 57 years of priesthood, I broke the second commandment. It's not about swearing, like, if I may use the word here, bloody. I could go further, but that's not swearing. Swearing is taking an oath in God's name. It's claiming that what you're saying comes from God. How often has that been done? When it doesn't come from God. It comes from my favoured theological positions or something. Well, we can offer that as long as it's humble and we let people know we're not talking on God's behalf. We're just searching for the truth as best we may. But here they are claiming God behind their human traditions. So there's the build-up to this. Now Jesus is saying quite plainly, the high court, the Sanhedrin, is going to condemn him. And after 3 days, I'll rise again. We can't get behind the drama to see what exactly Jesus said, of course. I mean, he can see the vultures gathering and he can see what's likely. But it all depends on human free decision and anything could happen. But no doubt after his death and after his resurrection, the disciples look back and remember how he implied that this discipleship isn't all going to be easy and it's going to be leading into trouble, which of course it did. In the other Gospels, they don't say after 3 days. They say on the third day, and you might be more familiar with that phrase. On the third day, rise again. So I need to, I don't need to, because it's not in Mark. Because of lest you get confused, I'm offering it to you here. This statement, on the third day, what does that mean? After 3 days means after he's really dead. But what's on the third day mean? Go back to Hosea chapter 6. Come, let's return to the Lord. It is he who is torn and he will heal us. He is struck down and he'll bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. And on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. So there's an ancient prophet using this expression, on the third day. The key to it, as I understand it, is found in this classical text of the most important book, really, of the Old Testament, the book of Exodus. It's Exodus chapter 9, and they've just crossed the Red Sea, travelled to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and this is what we read. And you'll notice the expression on the third day is mentioned 4 times in these 5 or 6 verses. Yahweh said to Moses, I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud, in order that the people may hear, when I speak with you, and so trust you ever after. Go to the people. God says to Moses, go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, have them wash their clothes and prepare for the third day. Because on the third day, Yahweh will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set limits for the people all around, saying, be careful not to go up the mountain, or to touch the edge of the mountain. Any who touch the mountain shall be put to death. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people. He consecrated them, and they washed their clothes, and he said to the people, prepare for the third day. Don't go near a woman. They weren't allowed to do that before battle and all this, so it's symbolic and cultural and relief that. On the morning of the third day, there was lightning and thunder, as well as a thick cloud on the mountain, and a blast of the ram's horn so loud that all the people in the camp trembled. On the third day becomes, because of this powerful scene here, a symbol of the day when God reveals who God really is. The day when we see, we can't not see the revelation on the third day. So when Jesus says, not here in Mark, but in Luke and Matthew, on the third day rise again, he's not measuring chronological time. He's saying, on the day when God reveals who... Okay, I'll... Being killed by the Sanhedrin is one thing, a lot of people were killed by them, so Jesus will be among them. But the key point is that on the day when God reveals who God is, I will be raised. He's confident in his Father's love and in the revelation of God. A small text, then I'll go on. Here's an intriguing little text in the book of Luke, chapter 13, which surely shows you that on the third day doesn't mean after 2 days. Here it is. Jesus, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow. And on the third day, I finish my work. Yet, he goes on, today, tomorrow, and the next day, which is not the third day, the next day, I must be on my way because it's impossible for a prophet to be killed outside Jerusalem. Having for the first time mentioned the possibility, probability of suffering in his journey, telling his disciples, Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. You're not going to suffer. You're the Messiah, for heaven's sake. Turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter and said, get behind me. In fact, the Greek is identical with his first words to Peter when he said, follow me. Opizomai. Follow me, get behind me. So it's got a different nuance here, but that's the same expression. Come, get behind me, Satan. Peter is an exemplification of one testing. Satan tested Jesus in the desert. Here is Satan testing Jesus again through this wonderful disciple called Peter, who's just acknowledged him as the Messiah. You're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Recalling the most important statement in Isaiah 55, which stands behind all theology. The best theology we can produce. And God says to the best theologian, let's say Thomas Aquinas for a minute, my thoughts are not your thoughts. And we've got to know that. God's thoughts are not ours. And your ways are not my ways. God is beyond words, beyond theology, beyond naming, beyond everything. It doesn't mean we sit back and do nothing. We do our best. We take our mind as far as it can go, honestly, knowing that it comes to a point where the mystery is always beyond. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. So any genuine theologian would be totally conscious of that and yet continue humbly trying to make meaning of experience. And now comes a critically important statement about us. Jesus called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If you want to follow after me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me." Once again, the phrase "take up your cross" may be there in the light of what happened to Jesus some year or more later. But in any case, deny yourself. Now, as we'll see in a minute, Jesus is not... the self is critical. You are unique. Yourself is God's gift to you and to us. But what we've got to be, as all the mystics tell us, everyone tells us, we've got to be able to deny the self. Able to. Not always denying it, but able to. Because if I'm not able to deny myself, then I'm a victim of my own habits, preferences, insecurity, self-image, whatever. So we have to be able to say no to the presenting self. Perhaps ego might be a good word for that. And then, lest we misunderstand that, the text goes on, if you want to save your life, and of course we want to save our life, psuche is the word all the way through here, your personal, relational, self-aware person, you, if you want to save you, if you want to save it, you'll lose it. If that's what your aim is, to hang on to it, you're going to lose it. If you actually lose your psuche, your life, because of me, because you follow Jesus, you end up losing it, the way Peter lost it later in the crucifixion, his crucifixion and so on. If you lose your life, if you give it away, if you waste it because of me and because of the gospel, you will save it. What will it profit you to gain the whole world and forfeit your life? Jesus doesn't want us to forfeit our life. He just doesn't want us to try and hold on to it and let it congeal behind a frightened, selfish self. He wants it. Think of the people in your life who are most generative. It's when they give themselves, you know, this, that they find themselves. If they hang on, not to lose what we've got, it'll go sour and bitter. And what will it profit you to gain the whole world if you lose your life? Indeed, what can you give in exchange for your life? You, your personal life. It's sacred, it's God-given, it's beautiful. But there's another self that can be the false self, we might call it, but it, partly true, partly false. We've got to be able to discern and deny self, to find our true self. Paul talks about your hidden self become strong. Those who are ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous has nothing to do with the sexual adultery, or it's to do with false gods, who are worshipping a false god. And sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. I don't know that it's significant, but that is the first time the word Father is used of God in Mark's Gospel. Matthew and John have it much more frequently. Jesus was saying to them, "Truly I tell you," we met that back in chapter 3, and I suggested maybe that's a little indication that we've got Jesus' remembered words here exactly as they were, of course in Greek, but from the Aramaic. "There are some standing here who will not taste death till they see that the kingdom of God has come with power. Quite a difficult little statement. It may well indicate for Mark, because the early church, Paul particularly, they all assumed, I'll use that word, that the end of the world was coming very soon. It was there. And in fact, they couldn't really think any other way, because the resurrection of Jesus for them was a sign that everything's about to rise. Just as if you were an orchardist or something, and as soon as the one tree has ripe fruit, it won't be long before the whole orchard's ripe. So you better start picking it, and etc. One rising from the dead, Jesus, the first fruits, well, it won't be long before we're all raised, and that's the end of this era. So that could be what Mark has in mind, mistakenly, but understandably. If the words came from Jesus, what might Jesus have had in mind? It's not impossible that he had the same assumption himself, but it might also mean there are some standing here who won't taste death, they'll be still alive, till they see the kingdom of God, the reign of God, coming with power. And since the reign of God is the reign of love, could the reference be to the crucifixion, to the revelation of love to the end? I don't know, but there's some of my thoughts on it. And now we come to a remarkable scene that sums up a lot of what we did yesterday. 6 days later, Jesus takes with him Peter and James and John and leads them up a high mountain apart by themselves. 6 days later, Exodus 24:16 reads, "The glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh, he called to Moses out of the cloud." And we're going to see a cloud again, and we're going to see God calling. So is that, I presume it is, where the 6 days comes from. It alludes to this scene in Exodus. Jesus was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white. Such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses. And they were talking with Jesus. So Jesus is in prayer. Something, the prayer shines through, let's put it simply. But the church came to see much more significance in this, much more meaning in it. And now we'll look at that as it's portrayed for us. That's actually Raphael's painting. I went to Rome, five times, I think, to do different courses and write books, as you probably noticed, and research and so on. And every time I went to Rome, the Raphael rooms were closed, except the very last time. And, of course, I kept searching, and they were closed for restitution, closed, closed, closed. And this time it was open. So I went in. This painting you're looking at there, it's actually a mosaic in the St. Peter's Cathedral. Well, you may have seen it there. See the basilica. Go up towards the main altar, and on the left, they've got this beautiful mosaic of this painting. But it's not the painting. painting itself is in the art gallery attached. Well, it is stunning. It's been cleaned up and all that. It is just so stunning as a painting. So why am I telling you that? Except do make sure if you go to Rome, you go and see it. Don't miss it. And don't be put off. Don't think you've seen it when you've looked at the mosaic. Exodus 34:30. Is this behind our text? Is this what's echoing in it? The Israelites saw Moses coming down from prayer with God. The skin of his face was shining, and they were afraid to come near him. Moses, having looked mouth to mouth with God, it's kind of so dazzling that the people can't look at it, and Moses had to cover his face to make it possible for them. It was too blinding. Peter says to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let's make three dwellings, three tabernacles. For you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." We've got it all together here. We've got Moses, who's the Torah. We've got Elijah, who's the prophets, the two, and they're the other writings, but they're the two basic texts of the sacred literature. And we've got them both there, and we've got Jesus as well. Let's have it all together. He didn't know what to say, we're told, because he was terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, the cloud of unknowing. The cloud that symbolizes the presence of God, but we can't see God. A cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud came a voice, echoing the scene at the baptism, but with a different angle on it. "This is my son, the beloved." We heard that at the baptism, because that was an experience of Jesus. This is an experience that we are having. "Listen to him." Now, it's not deliberately saying don't listen to Moses and don't listen to Elijah. That's taking it. But listen to him. And look at this. "Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, only Jesus." So the Mark, Peter, the early church came to see that however beautiful the books of Moses were, the Torah, and the books of Elijah, the prophetic books were, they're not with Jesus. We have to read them through Jesus' eyes. And you know the texts are not in Mark, they're in Matthew, where Jesus says, "It was said to you, but I say." It was said to you, "Hate your enemies, I say love them." So a lot of the Old Testament scriptures, of course, every sacred writing is written, but God doesn't write. God inspires, but a person that's inspired is still a person. If they're male or female, it's going to make a big difference. And if they're old or young, that's going to make a difference. So, and if they're Jewish or whatever, it's going to make a difference. So we've got to read all the Old Testament texts through the eyes of Jesus. And often we have to hear him say to us, "Yes, it was said." They got something, some insight into God, but it was flawed. It wasn't perfect. No blame on them. We have to see, what is Jesus saying alone? Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, "Whenever Moses is read," Moses meaning the Torah, "a veil lies over their minds. But when you turn to the Lord," which the scene's all about, look to him, listen to him, "when you turn to the Lord, the veil is removed." Clarity, revelation comes. "Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And all of us," says Paul, "with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror. Glory of Yahweh reflected in a mirror. It's the face of Jesus. He is the mirror in which we're seeing the face of God. We've tried to go along that track earlier. We're being transformed into the same image. Paul can say later, I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me. He was totally transformed so that there was only Christ there. Well, we're being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. It's a lifelong journey. And this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. Now, do this briefly and then get on to the next scene, which is all wrapped up in the one situation. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them to tell no one about what they'd seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what rising from the dead might mean. They were asking him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? That was the folklore. He was saying to them, Elijah is indeed coming first to restore all things. How then is it written about the Son of Man that he's to go through many sufferings and be treated with contempt? But I tell you, Elijah has already come. They did to him whatever they pleased, as is written about him. So this arm of the early church saw Jesus as suggesting that the Elijah they were expecting is John the Baptist. And he's already come. And look what happened to him. Now, when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. When the whole crowd saw Jesus, they were immediately overcome with awe and they ran forward to greet him. And he asked them, what's the argument about? That's the full painting of Raphael. Two scenes contemporary. The transfiguration there, and down here, a beautiful father here with his boy who's very mentally disturbed. And you've got, there's three disciples up there asleep. So there's 3 from 12 is what, 9? If you count these, there are 9 there. And just watch it. He's picked up the story beautifully. None of them are looking up to Jesus. They're reading the texts, they're discussing, they're pointing to this, they're doing this, there's something else going on here. The only one in the whole scene who's looking up to Jesus is the boy. He's the only one that sees. Yes, he's mentally handicapped enormously, but he's sensitive and he sees where the healing will come from. Raphael's introduced this person here who's not in the gospel story. And I was told, I haven't been able to be certain of this or find evidence of it, but when I first saw it, I was told that Raphael didn't call this the transfiguration, he called it faith. And she is faith. It's a bit obscure there because, you know, it's hard to get a reproduction. But if you looked at the original, this woman here is so strong. And she's looking at the 9, the disciples here, pointing back to the boy, and she's saying to them, why can't you do something? What are you doing waiting for? Who are you waiting for? Believe, do it. Get on with it. Be a disciple. Whatever of that, this is how the text goes. Jesus says, what are you arguing about? And someone from the crowd answered him, Teacher, I brought you my son. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they couldn't do so. And Jesus replied, Oh, you faithless generation, how much longer must I be among you? How much longer must I put up with you? Is anyone ever going to believe another gospel? Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes, will there be any faith on earth? Here he says, bring the boy to me. They brought the boy to Jesus, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell to the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the father, How long has this been happening to him? And the father said, From childhood. The spirit, that's their way of looking at it, has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you're able to do anything, have pity on us. Help us. And Jesus says to him, If you're able, all things can be done for the one who believes. Faith. Immediately, the father of the child cried out, one of our favourite texts, isn't it? I believe. Keep on helping my unbelief. Wants to believe more and more. When Jesus saw that the crowd was running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, You spirit that keeps this boy from speaking and hearing, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. After crying out and convulsing him terribly, the spirit came out. That's their worldview. Ours, I think, would be different. The love of Jesus brings peace to this broken boy. It came out and the boy was like a corpse. Most of them said he's dead. Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up. They're all resurrection terms, and you've heard that before for the daughter of Jairus, the same phrase. And he was able to stand. And when he'd entered the house, his disciples were asking him privately, Why couldn't we heal? And Jesus said to them, This kind can be healed only through prayer. Some ancient manuscripts have and fasting, and that found its way into the Latin and into old translations, but it doesn't seem to be part of the actual text. This kind can come out only through prayer. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. He didn't want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, and here's our second prediction, I don't think it's a very good word, but aloud, of the passion. The Son of Man is to be handed over to human hands. In the earlier one, it was the Sanhedrin. Now it's human hands. Because it involves also the Romans, as we'll see. And they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again. But they didn't understand what he was saying, and they were afraid to ask him. Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was at home, he was asking them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" They were silent, for on the way, they'd been arguing with one another who was the greatest. Now this scene, and we'll read it as it is in Mark, but this scene, Luke puts it in the Last Supper. So they've all got different, they want to say different things, they're different artists, of course. But here, at least at the Last Supper, it's so totally shocking. It's shocking enough here. And we better pick up a mirror and have a look and check our own behaviour. They're arguing who was the greatest. And he's just already told them to deny, learn to deny yourself, for heaven's sake. He sat down, called the 12, and says to them, "Whoever wants to be first among you must be the last of all and the servant of all." Here's the word diakonos, from which we get our word deacon. We've heard it twice so far in the Gospel. One was in the short account of the wilderness after the baptism, when the angels ministered to Jesus. And the other was when Simon's mother-in-law was raised by Jesus and she ministered to them. Diakonia. Then Jesus took a little child, put the child among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." Jesus identified as a child, because he called God Abba, Imma. So he's a child of God. Being a child is wonderful. And so he's asking all of us to be a child, to know that we don't determine much at all. We're welcoming everything as a grace, the way a child does, without too much convolution going on. And we conclude with this. John was saying to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he wasn't one of us." Does this get us into institutional pride and stupidities that go on? He wasn't one of us, so we tried to stop him. Behind that is a scene, this is a picture scene of the book of Numbers, when Moses is up on the mountain and he took 70 of the elders up. All very lovely for an ordination ceremony in a way. So he took them up to the mountain, the Spirit came down upon them and they prophesied. Everything's going fine for that 70. And then Joshua comes up to Moses and says, "Hey, there are two people down in the camp who didn't come up on the mountain. And they're down on the camp and they're, you know, talking about God. Stop them," he says to Moses. Oh God, it's dreadful. How often have we behaved like this? Stop them. And Moses, it's delightful, he says, "Oh God," he said, "if only everyone was a prophet. What on earth are you doing trying to stop them?" Here it is with Jesus. "We tried to stop them," says John, one of the Boanerges, you know, one of the sons of thunder. Jesus said, "Don't stop him. No one who does a deed of power, a miracle, in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. If you're not against me, you're for me." They're not against us, they're for us. Truly I tell you, third time we've heard that, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink, because you are my disciple, you bear the name Christ, will by no means lose their reward.